Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kathy Curtis, a longtime volunteer of the Commonwealth Club. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Bill Eggers. He is the Executive Director for the Deloitte Center for Government Rights. He's an author, columnist, consultant, and popular speaker for more than two decades. Bill Eggers is a leading authority on government reform who has advised governments around the world. He has written for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and is the author of nine books which have won numerous awards, hit bestseller lists, and have been named to 10 best books of the year lists. He coined the term Government 2.0 in a book by the same name. His latest book that he will discuss today is Delivering on Digital, the Innovators and Technologies that are Transforming Government, which bestselling author Daniel Pink calls a hopeful book that offers real solutions at a time when the digital revolution that has reshaped our lives risks passing government by. And his Twitter handle is @WDeggers. So please help me in welcoming Bill Eggers to the podium.
Well, thank you all so much for coming today. It's so great to see so many friends in the audience and people I've known for a long time. I want to start off by introducing you to my wife, Morgan. Now, this is Morgan, and she gets to wear these fancy, fun outfits like this because she dances for the Washington Ballet. And Morgan is right there, by the way. Say hi to Morgan. One of her favorite roles is playing the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland. And her favorite part is when she gets to mime off with her head to the guards. Now, my favorite part, one of my favorite scenes involving the Red Queen and Alice is in Carol's Through the Looking Glass. Now, in this scene, Alice and the Queen, they keep running, but they remain in the same spot. Do you remember that scene? Anyone? And in our country, Alice said, still panting, you generally get to somewhere else if you run very fast for a long time, as I've been doing. And then the Queen says, well, a slow sort of country. Now here you see it takes all the running you can do just to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. Now this is known as the Red Queen effect. And when it comes to keeping up with technology today, sometimes we feel a lot like Alice, right? Where we're just running faster and faster and faster trying to keep up. And it's just so hard to do it. I mean, for me, Snapchat is the killer for me. You know, and they're releasing a new feature every single day. This is a very popular one right now. And I can't keep up with it. But in general, we're in a society now where increasingly we feel that keeping up with technology is so, so hard. Harder than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and so forth. So why is that? It's because every other period of technological revolution that we've had, basically the 20th century infrastructures like telephones or electricity were characterized by what many call the S-curve. And that's essentially you had a burst of performance improvement and the technologies got better and better very quickly, but then they leveled off, leading to periods of relative stability. And that's where we got to figure out what to do with those technologies and how to adjust to them. Now, today's digital technology era is different. Basically, since Moore's Law, and we're now going on 50 years in terms of Moore's Law, digital technologies have been progressing on an exponential curve. They haven't slowed down. They get better and better and better and more rapidly. And so we've seen that with processing. We've seen that with storage. We're starting to see that with things like artificial intelligence and robotics. And what happens is we're getting more and more technologies, and they're getting better and better very, very rapidly. Now, there's also been these technology changes have also ushered in huge changes in institutions, particularly a shift from traditional institutions to networks and to individuals. The largest taxi company today owns no cabs. The most popular media owner creates no content. That's Facebook. The world's largest hotel chain, Airbnb, owns no real estate. And the world's most valuable retailer, Alibaba, has no inventory. Now, we've also seen, along with this rise in these market disruptors, we've seen trust and confidence in many traditional institutions have absolutely plummeted. Look at how people are looking at trust in banks, trust in newspapers, trust in big business. They've all declined rapidly over the last few decades. And almost nowhere is this more true than government, where faith in Congress and trust in the federal government at an all-time low. Just 19% of Americans say that they can trust the federal government always or most of the time. Now, how government adapts to all of these changes matters a lot. This is the landscape our governments are operating in: massive and rapid technological change, large-scale shift away from traditional institutions to new institutional forms, and a growing mistrust among the voters. And I hold that it doesn't matter whether you're someone who loves government or you hate government, or you're somewhere in between, like many people are. It matters a lot that government gets digital technologies and this technological revolution right. It matters for a lot of reasons. Government touches all of our lives in so many right ways. It's the roads that we drive on, the water that we drink, the schools that teach our children, the food safety inspections that make us confident about our food. And every single company, every entrepreneur interacts with government on a very regular basis. And we can't be in a society where government is not closely following the private sector in terms of where technology is. And so that's why it's so important. And sometimes this can even mean the difference between life and death, how government works, how government operates. So this is what happened with the VA, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. It had epic backlogs, which you've read about, resulted in dozens of deaths and the redirection of care from vets to other channels of care. So why did some of this happen? Well, if you actually look at it, at the height of the problems, that the department was a collection of over 1,000 websites, 956 helplines, 42 call centers, 220 separate databases. It was so complex it almost had to fail. Now, I'm happy to report that a lot of fixes are happening right now at the VA. But still, the complexity then of government really negatively impacted a lot of people. Now, another thing a lot of us have had to deal with is looking at care for adults, whether they have mental health issues or aging parents or grandparents. And it's oftentimes really hard to navigate those systems and to find that care, right? Really, really hard. And in fact, people with a serious mental illness in the U.S. die on average 25 years more than their peers. But we've all experienced kind of that frustration of trying to navigate these very complex systems and not being able to do so. Now, the good news is that digital technologies give us the opportunity to fix these problems. They give us opportunities in many ways to simplify, to bring user-friendliness to these problems, and that's some of what we have the opportunity to do with digital technologies today. Now, but we have to get it right, and we don't always get it right. Healthcare.gov was a massively expensive, complicated failure of a launch. It was probably one of the biggest public policy launch failures that we've seen in decades. Yet, I will argue that it ended up being the best thing that ever happened to digital government in the United States. Why? Because what it did was it focused the attention of the President of the United States, of the whole cabinet, of millions of citizens on how a website should work and how it shouldn't work, right? And what it did was it led to a whole series of changes. This crisis created opportunity in a way, and we saw more changes happen in the last 2 years since this happened than we saw in maybe the previous 10 years. As the President Obama himself said, there's a larger problem. That is the way the federal government does procurement, and IT is just generally not very efficient. So you had the President of the United States focus like a laser on how do we change our IT procurement problems. It seems like something, how does that get, but it's important. Out of the rubble of the disaster emerged a whole array of much-needed changes in people, procurement, and delivery, and it included an unprecedented drive to bring 500 of the tech industry's best and brightest into the federal government to fix a lot of these problems. And many of these tech people were from companies here, from Facebook, from Google, and from many of the top tech companies. And why did they come? Because they wanted to fix problems. They wanted to do something big and do something important. Now, this group of individuals was profiled in Time magazine and many other places, but they were able to kind of, out of this rubble, to create something very, very different. And we've seen a lot of needed changes occur. Now, when I talk about digital transformation of government, then a lot of the things you're going to hear, people will just say, wow, I just feel like we're so far behind. I don't know what I can do. And we feel like we're like Sisyphus in that Greek myth, right? We're pushing this big boulder up a hill and it just is so hard. How do we get from here to there? And I get that. I really understand what that feels like. I've been in government, I've been in private sector and the nonprofit sector, and I'll say it's just harder to get these things done in government oftentimes because of politics, incentives, and culture. But, you know, there's a really good answer for how do you go about this. And what that answer is you follow kind of the tech mindset, which is about you hack away at the problems, at the current systems. You don't try to do it all at once. You don't say we're going to do that. What you say is that we're going to climb this road, but we're going to essentially do it one step at a time. We're going to iterate. We're going to find a solution to a problem, do a task. We're going to fix a system that is inefficient and inelegant or even unfathomable, but which nevertheless you can make work. And this is the way that we're seeing digital innovators in San Francisco and Washington, D.C. and London and Seoul are going about trying to make government, bring government, pull government into the 21st century. Now, one of the key things you find with a lot of these innovators is they have this digital mindset. And the digital mindset is just different than traditional mindsets. It's held by many of you, I think, in the room. Now, this is Mike Bracken. Hello, I'm Mike Bracken. I'm from the internet. That's how the former chief digital officer for the United Kingdom opened his speech on digital transformation at the Institute for Government in London. Now, from there, he proceeded to take on all of the venerable traditions of the civil service system of the United Kingdom, which had existed for 150 years. And it was a fascinating, fascinating thing. So get things right the first time. That's what we always hear, right? No, said Bracken. Instead, it's better still to fail first, fail cheap, and put things right later. Policy is king, is what we hear with civil service. No way, says Bracken, delivery should be the fundamental organizing principle of civil service. And he also said, rather than have a bunch of generalist policymakers, what you want to do is flood government with digital innovators, people who know how to actually get things done, and then get out of their way and let them do things. Now, you can agree or disagree with Bracken, but the key thing is that his mindset is represented by a growing cadre of people from in Washington, here in San Francisco, and in government capitals across the world right now. These are the digital innovators with a digital mindset. This digital mindset is just different than traditional mindsets. It's a strong belief in openness and putting all of their code out there on GitHub when they're working on government projects, simplicity, a really extreme belief in user centricity, focusing on the end citizen or business, agility and doing things with agile way, and co-creating with citizens and bring citizens, businesses, and others into the process. I like to say, after interviewing 200 people who are digital innovators, it feels to me like the future kind of fights are not going to be less maybe conservative than liberal than about people with this digital mindset versus those who have a very traditional mindset. It really is that different. One of the key elements of this is simplicity and about just a really a core belief in taking very complex things and making it simple, more nimble, more streamlined, and how important that is. If you approach something like, well, the citizen just didn't understand, they filled out the form wrong, they did this, well, that's wrong because you didn't present it in a way. So if you want to look about, and one of the people who I love who talks about this is Jen Palka. Jen is the CEO for Code for America. I'm sure some of you know her. She said, our government is addicted to complexity in a way that isn't serving us well, and the complexity itself is actually the problem. Code for America is working with governments up and down the state of California and elsewhere to try to take those very complex sort of things, whether it's on food stamps and other areas, and simplify it for individuals. So speaking of complexity, this is one of my favorite examples, which is essentially parking signs. And in this parking sign, basically, you would need a PhD in many respects and write an algorithm to actually figure out when to actually park there, right? This is a parking sign in Seattle right now. But we've all seen things like that. And you can stare at it for minutes and minutes at a time and just throw your hands up, right? That makes no sense at all. And then they just say, well, it's the citizen's fault. They didn't understand it. Well, some of you, are any of you designers here? Designers, very good. And you do user experience and so forth. Well, this is just a design challenge, right? And so how would a designer look at that? Well, a designer out of Los Angeles got fed up at the same time and said, I'm just going to come up with a new way of doing parking signs. And this is what it looked like, right? A new parking sign in Los Angeles, which basically shows visually in a very simple way when you can park and when you can't park there. And eventually this will all be digital, of course. But why did it take so long for these things to happen, right? So Los Angeles is now redesigning all of their parking signs to essentially be simple and user-friendly like this. And that's another key principle of the digital mindset, is that the user is always king. The user knows better, and we don't know when we're doing usually, so government will do a lot of policy writing and a lot of things, never really talk often to the real users of those services, right? People are doing it, and people with digital mindset said, you can't do a service, you can't do a program without getting in there and talking to real users. The user is the king in many respects. And it seems very simple, but it's very different than oftentimes how organizations have gone before. So let's look at a couple areas of how do you kind of hack government bureaucracy. How do you hack bureaucracy? What are some of these innovators doing right now? Well, the most important thing, the first thing you have to do is you actually have to get capacity. How do you bring in the people who know how to do this? How do you get, you know, these sort of people with a digital mindset, the sought-after people, to agree to a lesser-paying government job to come in there and do this? That's not an easy thing to do, especially here, right, in the Bay Area. Well, the most powerful tool you have to entice them is mission. Technology people love solving problems and entice them with the promise of solving a flawed system, Let them make a difficult issue easy for millions of people. Humbly asking someone for help can go a long, long way. Mission and solving problems is the most important thing. Now, secondly, you have to adapt to them. They're not going to adapt to you, right? And that's a really key element, and that when organizations are trying to attract millennials and others and everything, well, they have to understand the kind of mindset and how people want to enter work. Now, one of the key elements there is that you have to recruit from sites where they actually frequent, like 37signal, Stack Overflow, and GitHub. Now, techies love to snoop under the hood, like kind of look at source code and understand what it is. And so just like car enthusiasts like to look under the hood and look at the engines. And so what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was one of the first digitally first government agencies in the digital era, what they did was they hid their job descriptions in the source code, right? Pretty cool. And what does that say? That says, we get you. We understand you in a way that others didn't. Now, another really interesting thing is what the Navy did. They were trying to figure out, how do we attract more cryptographers? And it turns out that a lot of cryptographers actually love playing like virtual reality and augmented reality. So this is what they did to try to attract them.
For a select few. It's the part of the Navy that creates codes and breaks codes. We understood the kind of people the Navy was looking for, and so we chose the right medium to attract them. An alternate reality game, or ARG. The ideal Navy cryptologist is self-motivated and highly intelligent. An intuitive problem solver. This is a very small, very specific group to target. That's why an ARG was the right way to micro-target them. ARG players have the exact skill set the Navy is seeking. ARG gamers are also interconnected. We were tapping into an entire community. This was a natural method to interest and engage them.
Well, that's pretty cool, too. They created an alternate reality game, right, as a way of recruiting individuals. And people say government can't be in. That's really innovative, right? And there's no reason. So it just takes this sort of real creativity and understanding, again, adapting to them. Where are they and how do you attract them? Now, adapting to them also means creating an environment where people like to work. And that means for technologists, flat, open, collaborative, having the latest and greatest technology, the ability to make a difference. And of course, casual dress code is important. Some technologists, they might actually even wear hoodies, right? And they may actually have green hair and earrings through their nose coming in. Now, I tell you a funny story. I was speaking to a lot of aspiring CIOs in one state, and I was giving a workshop on all of this, and I was talking about adapting to them and people wearing hoodies coming in, and this one guy just went berserk, and he said, we can't have a bunch of kindergartners running around here who are unsupervised and not looking professional and this and that. And what happened was, after the tirade, people went around the room and started talking about how these individuals, who might look a little bit different than the typical government employee, were some of their very, very best people, story after story after story. They didn't look the part, maybe, and so forth. The next day, half the class, and the average age was probably, 50-something years old, half the class came in hoodies, okay, to show that they get it. They got that. And, these are things that we just have to, again, adapt to. Another thing is the long forms that you have in government. So right now it takes about 6 to 9 months, oftentimes, the federal government to actually close a deal and hire someone. For a grid technologist, forget about it, right? They're going to say sayonara after a fierce couple weeks. So 18F, which is the federal government's digital studio and has an office out here, what they did was they were able to take that down, again, through hacking away at the process, take it down from 6 to 8 months to 6 to 8 weeks. And that's what you have to do. Now, another key thing is I believe in a digital age that it can't just be a small group of people that understand digital. You actually need to get a lot of your workforce, at least some degree of digital savviness. But how do you do that? You're never going to be able to hire, 20,000 new people. What that means you have to do is reskill them. Now, this guy is Kevin Cunnington. He was the former He's the senior government executive, and he's dealing with the same problem. Many of his department's employees lack digital skills, but he didn't have the time or all the money to hire a whole bunch of new people. So what he did was he created something called the Digital Academy. And he sent them to this. What it is it's a 6-week boot camp. It teaches key concepts like prototyping and user experience and how to do agile and so forth. And they basically go through this course and they come out of it and they're not experts on it, but they know a little bit. And then what they do is they're connected with an expert as kind of what the Brits call a plumber's mate model. And their jobs change afterwards. And over time, they're trying to get tens of thousands of people through this digital academy to reskill them. We're also seeing a lot of companies starting to do this. AT&T has made that commitment to reskilling employees. And you know, when you talk to the employees who have gone through this and are learning these really interesting new things, they love it. They get so excited about it. But we need to make those kind of commitments. So lastly, San Francisco is doing some really, really wonderful things here. One of the things that San Francisco is doing is tapping into the wider technology ecosystem, because there's always going to be more technologists outside your organization than inside. And so my friend Jay Nath, who's the head of innovation for the city, has created this program called San Francisco Entrepreneurship in Residence. And what they've done is essentially said, we're going to make San Francisco the world's leader in the Internet of Things. And one of the ways we're going to do this is we're going to make kind of the city a sandbox for a lot of startups where they can try use cases and they could try to build models. What happens is they have nominations, like 300 nominations I think they got in their last round. And then the winners, the small group of winners, get to work with city agencies for a period of about 9 weeks to actually get their concepts in use and in play. Now, they don't necessarily get paid for it, but what it does is it gives them a use case to go out there. It's a great example of like working with startups, working with the private sector to accomplish something that's in both sectors' interest. San Francisco has also just recently created a space that I went to today called Super Public, which is basically a collaboration space between all the levels of government to look at all of those issues that are, you know, multi-governmental issues that seem so complicated and hard, and say, we can fix these things if we get together and work together. I'm going to talk a little bit now about how do you actually then deliver these things. So I wrote a book, co-authored a book a number of years ago called If We Can Put a Man on the Moon. In that book, we looked at over 200 major government projects since World War II. It was a big research project. And we just tried to figure out why some succeeded and why some failed. And what I want to say about, and then in this book, I looked at dozens more cases, and doing digital delivery is different than traditional. You could be the best project manager in the world at traditional program delivery and still not do digital well. And we found some of that out with healthcare.gov. And why is that? Well, so digital is just different. And one of the things that's different is that you need to start from a place of ignorance. Now, this might sound like absolute blasphemy, right, in government. Government agencies are specifically designed to project confident superiority and a sense of infallibility, you know? But in fact, the key to doing digital is to start from placing, we don't actually know until we get started how the end users are going to want to interact with us. We don't actually know the answer to these questions and all the complexity. And we're going to go through a process of finding that out through iteration, through learning and testing and everything else. Now, that is so radically different than how governments have operated throughout our entire history. But that's the only way to do digital well, because you don't know ahead of time what's going to work. And you also have to be willing to make mistakes. As James Joyce said, a man's mistakes are his portals to discovery. But if we start from a place of ignorance, we give ourselves a chance to succeed. Now, a project that starts from a place of ignorance, also, what you do is you learn how to walk in other people's shoes, right? You actually show empathy, and you get out there and say, what is that like for the citizen, for the business, for that customer of the service? And you have to be able to walk in their shoes. in order to succeed. An empathetic leader knows the end users and knows how to get there. So let me give you an example of this. Walk in their shoes is the approach that Texas took when it was trying to do something. They have a big integrated, what's called an integrated eligibility system, but the key thing is that they were trying to make it mobile enabled. Okay, this was for people who are on public assistance right now. It's already one-stop shop, and they said, we want to put that on mobile devices. Now, a lot of people would say, well, why would you do that? Because a lot of the constituents you're trying to reach they don't have smartphones, they don't have mobile devices, they're not going to know how to use it well. What they actually said here was that we're going to have to go out and test it with them. So we went into a lot of the service centers, and one of the questions was, one of the biggest problems essentially here was that if you're on assistance, you have to send in a whole bunch of forms to get verification documents, essentially to get on TANF and other programs. And they have to usually go into the service centers because they might not have access to scanners, faxes, and so forth. So the people who are looking at this said, why can't you send the banks essentially allow you to just take a picture, right, from the app, a picture of the check, and send it in? Why can't would they do the same for all of these documents? Now, we knew that something like that is technically possible, but would people actually use it? Would it work for these users? And now a lot of people were very skeptical. But then you go into the service centers and you look at the lines, and the people who were trying to receive services were just like all the rest of us. They were like on their smartphones, looking away at that. And then once we did more user research and really got in there, it turned out that the majority of these individuals actually did have smartphones. They might not be the latest generation. And then not only that, but they were really, really good at using them, because a lot of them, people didn't have laptops, they didn't have desktops, and so they had to do so many other things on them. And so in the end, what happened was, by going out there, talking to real users, interviewing them, doing observation, came up with a program and came up with an app within a month, and the mobile document upload surpassed those from desktops. And a few months later, the app had been downloaded 300,000 times. Literally within a couple months, this became the most popular way of essentially sending in documents. And these are for individuals who people would have assumed wouldn't have access to smartphones, wouldn't know how to do it and everything. And the key thing there is you can never make those assumptions. You want to test your assumptions with real users, and you want to start small and get this minimal viable product. Now, that's a small example, but it's an important one, because for everything that government does, we need to be doing that same sort of thing, never making any assumptions about how people actually want to interact until you go out there and test it. I want to just say one thing about procurement, because a lot of what government does is actually buy services, technology from the private sector. The federal government alone spends about $90 billion on IT services. And if you include state and local governments, you're talking hundreds of billions more. And about 75% of that is actually just spent maintaining kind of a lot of old, legacy, antiquated systems, unfortunately. Now, a lot of problems are within the system. And when you buy badly, then essentially you're wasting taxpayer money, but you're also not delivering on this. So you all have seen the Star Wars films, and you remember the Death Star, right? So the Death Star was this undefeatable ultimate weapon that was kind of brain-meltingly complex, ravenously consumed all these resources. And the first Death Star fired its main weapon only once before being destroyed. And the problem with the Death Star was just so mind-numbingly complex, right? And it was so hard to operate. And what we've done too oftentimes is we've created that same sort of thing when we have these big government IT projects that you read about in the newspaper, right? You read about these big failures of $20, $30 million projects that take 10 years to do, and by the time they're finished, the technology is totally antiquated. We can't build like that anymore. In the digital age, there's no reason to do that. We don't want to have the big Death Star approach. We want to have smaller, agile projects. One example of this is something that Mark Schwartz, who is the CIO for the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, has been doing. And they, what they do is they take on only small requirements at a time and push them all the way through to production. So this is how they do it. Rather than just choosing one big vendor and all or nothing kind of blind marriage approach, what he does is this. They say, okay, we're going to hire four different contractors, and they're all going to be doing different agile sprints. Then they're all going to be doing different things, and they're going to each get a certain amount of money, and we're going to be watching them, and we're going to be measuring how well they do, and they also have to work with each other. And the ones that start doing really well, they actually get more work, right? The ones who start doing not as well, they get less work and less money. Every 6 months, the teams are readjusted. And sometimes teams might actually go away. Well, what that does is it makes much better use of taxpayer money, but it also de-risks things at the beginning, right? You can actually see the people you're working with and how well they're doing all throughout, rather than essentially just crossing your fingers at the beginning. Let me end by talking about reimagining government. We've upgraded digital capacity, but now this is all about, how do you reimagine, use digital to totally reimagine how government operates? Now, imagine only having to give your information to government once, ever. Every level of government. Can you imagine that? Huh? No? No. Okay, no. In Estonia, citizens can access, they only have to give their information to any level of government once. They have a digital identity that's protected through cryptology. And basically, any service they want to do is digitized. Typically, they can register a new company online. It takes less time than it takes to finish a cup of coffee. They can do their taxes just by going, yes, 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 click, because it's all pre-populated. And here's a really interesting thing. They can see every government agency and government official who has tried to access their information. So there's transparency. And if you are not authorized to do that and you've accessed it, you could actually go to jail. This is Estonia, a country of 1.3 million who, you know, not that long ago was part of the Soviet system. They have a digital mindset. The president, he's in his 60s now, but he learned to code in New Jersey when he was in junior high, okay? So he brought that mindset to them. Okay, can you imagine every child at school getting personalized learning that adapts to the child's learning habits? Now, that would seem to be a very expensive proposition, right? To get personalized learning for every single child. I mean, you have to have a teacher or coach there for every child, right? Well, wrong. There's schools here in San Francisco called Alt School, which some of you may have heard of, where essentially it works very, very different. It provides personalized learning that adapts to the child's learning habits. Here's how Alt Schools works. At traditional schools, the curriculum and the learning plan is developed by the state and local school board. At Alt School, students actually get to play a part in that. Students and parents and teachers are basically developing these learning playlists. Now, at traditional schools, a lot of the curriculum and execution, everything is developed by, you know, the school board and other authorities. At an Alt School, basically, it's through this very collaborative process. And what happens is that the lesson plans and the learning is changed out on a regular basis based on how individuals are actually learning on a regular basis. And you can do that with digital technology now. And that's the beauty of it. You're being able to provide a personalized sort of approach for every student. And we can do that with a lot of different services today, thanks to technology. Now, another one is, imagine no one in your city having to own a car, but still getting wherever they want, whenever they want. Okay? Yes. The city of Helsinki has an audacious goal. By 2025, it plans to eliminate the need for any city resident to own a private car. The idea is to combine public and private transport providers so citizens can assemble the fastest or cheapest mode of transit at all times. Bus routes would not be fixed, but dynamic, depending on what the supply and demand is at any one time. And not only that, but every sort of service, whether it's through the sharing economy, through the public sector that you want to access, you can access on your phone in real time, essentially. And so if you are a family and you're taking the kids to soccer and you've got others, you could actually then arrange a number of times a week for buses to be coming and doing that transport. And they're looking at all those different sort of user experiences. And they're saying, how do we connect through digital means all of this? So what Helsinki is doing is they're flipping transportation over. So instead of it being all about the infrastructure, what it is, it's basically saying it's all about individual mobility, providing individual mobility personalized for every individual using digital. Now, this is what's possible today. This is the beauty of digital technologies. One other last example. So we have like about 1.5 million people in our prison systems today who are nonviolent offenders. Now, and they're not paying taxes, their families are being destroyed oftentimes, whole communities are being destroyed. Well, with digital technologies, essentially through electronic monitoring and cell phones, you could actually virtually you could basically virtually ring fence people so that they could actually still be in the community, but they're still, you know, paying their dues in many respects, but they're paying taxes, they're having a job, and you're not doing those things. And that's about reimagining what government should look like, how it should operate in today and tomorrow's world. I mean, the possibilities are really amazing, and it's just our imagination that's going to stop that. And getting the right capacity, getting the right skill sets, and so forth in there. So I hope you enjoyed the speech and you learned a little bit about it. This is really, really so important for succeeding. I'm actually really excited about a lot of what the city of San Francisco is doing. I think it's becoming a leader in many respects. You're going to hear a lot more about smart cities over the next few years and autonomous vehicles and all sorts of other things. But first, we have to get digital right. Thank you so much.
I'm Kathy Curtis, tonight's Commonwealth Club Program Chair. You are listening to Bill Eggers, Executive Director of the Deloitte Center for Government Rights, talk about transforming government with a digital mindset. Now it's time for audience Q&A. People have questions, please raise your hand.
Hi, thanks for the talk. Really great. So I think a lot of us agree with the direction that you're pointing in and a lot of the concepts here, but it's not the current reality. Some things are moving. Can you talk a little bit about why we don't have this today and what are the barriers in the real world government that are preventing us from achieving some of this potential that you talked about, the real hard things that need to be overcome in order to achieve some of these things?
Well, so you need political leadership. You the kind of leadership that President Obama like supplied after the healthcare.gov we saw in the UK with David Cameron. That's absolutely necessary. You need someone who's going to drive a lot of these changes through. And you need a cadre of individuals who are committed to this and who are going to spend some time. There's a lot of battles that you have to do because this is taking on a lot of entrenched systems right now. A lot of people don't like change very much. They're nervous about these changes. A lot of individuals just say, you know, I've got X amount of years left. I don't understand it all. And it seems so different and they look different than me. And so I think there's a lot of cultural barriers to that too. You know, there's resources in some respects, but doing these digital projects in a way is actually a lot less expensive than a lot of traditional kind of custom IT projects. And so I think we need more leaders who are going to put this at the top of their agendas and make this really important and understand just how I would say important it is to the, you know, to the functioning of government, to the future, to citizen trust right now. Well, I mean, I think citizens need to be demanding it in many respects more. And you know, some of that's going to be, you know, the new generations of individuals coming in the federal government. So in the general population, the workforce, millennials have just become the biggest cohort of workers. And so they're over about 23% of all employees. Guess what they are in the federal workforce today? And it's like 7-8%. Very, very low. That number tells you a lot right there. That's like, you know, that's helping you to understand some of those problems. You need to get a lot more new blood in who think about this in a different way.
Yes. Thank you. I'm a retired Fed working on human capital in the federal statistical system, so take your point very well. Because when we manage folks, we manage people that are like 80 years old and 18 years old. So we got all these cohorts and the people who put folks on the moon. We had real rocket scientists. The people who invented internet do come out of the government.
Exactly.
So my question to you is, the examples you use, like Estonia and Helsinki, really are not appropriate to San Francisco or the United States, because we've got a much larger population. And coming out of the Census Bureau, we know we've got more heterogeneity coming along and that people are mobile. So our problem has been, yeah, we get the census and we've got all these administrative records. However, you know, you look at the data and you really can't go with that stuff because people change their answers over time. We change our questions over time, the compatibility over time of administrative records, you know, that whole stuff. A lot of people don't understand how to use data. I mean, that's a real basic problem. So have you done any examples like with more heterogeneous and bigger populations, or like someplace like India or China, which is really where the U.S. is headed?
So first of all, I'd say, you know, absolutely agree with you. It's really important that digital savviness has nothing to do with age in many respects. My uncle Hugh is here, one of the first inventors of video games, and we have many people like that in this Bay Area and elsewhere, very, very, very savvy digitally. So I think that's, in terms of technology, that's an important point. Secondly, there's lots of examples in the book from the UK, from the US, from throughout Europe, and from many other countries, Australia, New Zealand. I want to say one thing. I absolutely do believe that what's going on in Helsinki, what's going on in Holland, what's going on in Estonia is absolutely relevant. I mean, Estonia is about the same size of a city, right? A U.S. city. And I think, so there's a lot of things that we can learn from each other. In the U.S., so I've been doing public policy now for 26 years or so. In the U.S., we are, more than almost any other country, the first thing we always say is, we're different. We're bigger, we're different, that doesn't apply to us. And other countries spend so much time really trying to understand what's best practices all over the world. If you look at the smart cities movement and what mayors are doing, they're not just looking at, they're looking all over the world for the best examples, and they're talking to each other, they're sharing best practices and sharing lessons learned. From an Asia perspective, Korea is one of the leading countries in the world. From a digital perspective, they were a leading country in e-government. And why was Korea such a leader? Because they said, we want to be a technological powerhouse. We want to be one of the centers of technology in the world. And to do that, our government needs to be one of the best in the world at this. We can't lag behind. And so they had a very, very systematic effort for over a decade to do that. And now they've landed themselves mostly, almost always, in the top five. Singapore is also one of the best governments in the world from a digital perspective. You had a question. And I think you have to...
This whole IT situation is so heavily fragmented. Who's trying to funnel this, all these apps and user-friendly, make pages user-friendly, because they're really archaic. The IT industry today, in my head, is very archaic. It's been doing this for 30 years, 40 years. They're still stumbling. Where's the clearinghouse? Where's the refinement that can bring all these apps where you don't need so many apps. I mean, you can drive a car, an automobile, that's 100 years old. They're very user-friendly. Web pages are not user-friendly. And you can go on 5 different web pages and try to find your way through someplace, even you, who's a master at technology, and you would get lost on some of these web pages because you don't know what button to push and what it does, et cetera. So you need some kind of refinement, I would think, where you can teach all these technology people. I don't want you to think in one mindset, but I do want you to conform to a system that can be used by the total public.
It's not user-friendly. IT is not user-friendly. I'm sorry. And they've been at it a long time.
Sure, I think I'll respond, and I think people in the audience might want to respond too. I actually think then if you look at some of the leading technology companies right now in the U.S. and around the world, they're actually the ones that have figured out what you've said, is that the best sort of companies are the ones that are able to take the complex and design a very simple, intuitive, user-focused interface. That's why Airbnb is now the largest provider of accommodations in the world. That's why Uber and Lyft have been so popular. That's why essentially I saw some statistic about how much time the average American spends on Facebook every day, and it's just astounding, right? And it's all because they're able to do that and make these what could be incredibly complex processes very, very simple. And a lot of why I wrote this book was, how do we do that for government? How do we make that same, take all that complexity out, and what are the killer apps that we can create? And then, you know, eventually I think you'll be able to have this more of an interface. What Estonia is trying to do now is basically create something where most of the time you just one or two clicks away, that you know your digital identity, and what they're saying is we want friction-free government, and sometimes even invisible, where instead of coming to ask you and saying you need to renew your license for this, you need to do this, we're going to do this for you already behind the scenes, because we don't need to bother you again for that. And I think that's where we need to go. But it's not just technologists. It's actually the people who are going to figure this out in many respects are going to be the designers, the people who really understand user experience and who are good at that. And I think one of the biggest things that could change government really was to train and hire thousands of people to do user experience in government.
I just want to make a comment. Microsoft has made so many non-user-friendly programs. I mean, it's ridiculous. This is a top-notch, quote-unquote, top-notch technology company. Look at the errors that they and every time they make Yahoo. Every time Yahoo now, when you go on and try to use Yahoo, I mean, you just throw your hands in the air. Just leave it alone. Put out a good system and leave it alone. You know, you want to use Yahoo's financial page, now you got a whole new, this is over here, that's over.
So I want to talk about the CX thing, segue into what you're just talking about. Yeah. So Airbnb and Uber have delivered a better customer experience than the government. And so they've got all the usage and all the data. Right. So the question is really about when you look at New York City, where the attorney general is suing Uber for not releasing data. You look at New Orleans, where Airbnb is not releasing data. How do you see the sort of lockdown private sector in terms of urban data, sharing that or not sharing that, and what are your thoughts about making that more porous?
Yeah, I mean, the data, you know, data is the new currency, right? And in many respects, so government has three roles with this new currency. One, as a regulator of the data, which you're talking about, one as a user of data, and one as producer. Government produces a massive amount of data right now, the Census Bureau. And by the way, a little commercial, we built something with MIT Media Lab called Data USA, which is the biggest visualization of U.S. government data that existed. There are over 1.8 million visualizations, 30,000 jurisdictions. Wonderful thing for high school students, college students, but it was exactly trying to apply user experience and user insights to data to make it more accessible. I think what we're going to start to see is this notion of open data and what it is. We're going to start seeing big changes where we're going to start seeing the private sector opening up a lot more. We're seeing it right now with pharma companies. A number of the major European pharma companies have said that they're going to put out all their clinical trial data out there. All of the organizations that get funding from the Gates Foundation and the healthcare area, one of the preconditions is making their data available. In the Hillary Clinton, and she had a technology and innovation proposals that she, a speech she gave a number of weeks ago, and one of the proposals was actually to say, how do we reduce some of the friction between government and business by using open data? And so think about, I was asked the other night, what's the biggest government innovation in the last 10 years that's impacted my life? Thought about it a little bit, and I said, you know what? As a person who travels 100,000 miles a year, it's TSA Pre, or Global Entry. It's actually made travel almost back to pre-9/11. Now, there's a couple really important things about it. So what it did was, it was innovation, because innovation is about breaking trade-offs. And in that case, the trade-off was before we had security here and convenience there, and we said it's going to be about security, right? With TSA Pre, you have just as much security because I've given all this data, right, that they can have, and I get much more convenience. And so I think that notion of how do we get a situation where maybe businesses and other organizations, in return for giving a lot more data and giving a pipeline, they get more of a fast-track process, and you start reducing it. So that's where I think we're going to start seeing a lot more innovation and opening up of data so researchers from others can actually utilize it from a broader societal standpoint. Yes, Hugh.
In San Francisco, to get a building permit, you have to drive down to the building department at Venice Avenue. You pull out a form. You spend about 10, 15 minutes filling out the form. A lot of questions you don't know the answers to. What's the building classification? What is type? Then you pull a number, you sit in line, and you hand the form to the lady. And the first thing she does for 5 minutes is type all the information into the computer. And she'll say, oh, wait, you've got the wrong building class here. Well, then why did you ask? So I'm wondering, could you go talk to the chief building inspector and tell him there's a far easier way to do this?
Well, what I can do is... The city of Boston was like that up until recently. A new mayor came in, and he said, you know, we're hearing so many complaints about this. And so what they did was they massively streamlined the permitting process. And one of the most important things that they did was said, every company, everyone that wants to get a building permit of any, they're going to get to see where that is at all times, whose desk that's on or whatever and everything, and have total transparency into it, but also find ways of radically reducing that time involved in actually doing the permitting process. I just wrote a case on it. And so what I will do is I will actually send that over to my friends in City Hall and say, you should talk with the Boston folks, because I think that's an area where, you know, to be frank, 10 years ago, we should have fixed that. 10 years ago, during the eGov era, we should have fixed the building process in a lot of areas like that. They should be seamless, transparent, and you can collapse that time very, very dramatically, I think, through that transparency and digitizing the operation from the very start to the very end. Chris, hi.
When looking at the different levels of U.S. government, do you see more opportunity in maybe municipal versus federal, or is it more of a holistic opportunity?
Well, certainly, I mean, cities, and you know, they're closer to the individuals. It's always been where you've seen a lot of innovation, especially now. So what cities are doing now is they're probably better than any other level of government. They're saying, government, we can't do it alone. We need to involve nonprofits, foundations, the private sector, and others. And mayors are just generally kind of more used to doing that, I think. And so you see a lot of that going on here in San Francisco, which is reaching out, tapping into the broader ecosystem. But also, from a technology standpoint, one of the biggest things in government is the smart cities movement. And that's happening in countries all over the world. And that's basically where you're going to get all sorts of data in, and you're putting sensors all throughout the city, and you really are dramatically changing the interaction that citizens have in that in the city, and trying to make it more sustainable, trying to do transportation patterns in a much better way. Some of it's getting ready for autonomous vehicles when they come in the next 5 to 7 years. So I definitely think that cities are, provide some of the best opportunities, but we also need, I mean, states do a lot of major programs themselves, a lot of the human services, and the federal government at the same time is where so much of the spending is. But I know a lot of people believe that they can make a biggest impact more quickly at the city level.
Hi, Chris Hewer. First of all, thank you, Bill, for spending and investing your life in this work. It's super important, and there's not enough people doing it, as you know, unfortunately. So I want to talk about a structural issue, and I don't know that I'll be able to frame it in a question, but I know you'll be able to respond. So innovation requires failure.
Right.
Failure in government becomes a political issue that takes away perhaps your job, your livelihood, or other stuff, unless we're talking about civil servants, in which case they actually are supposed to be there forever and not have that fear. Yep, they do have that fear, and they won't try new things, and they won't engage in this risky behavior. They're trying to de-risk and simplify their lives. So there's a structural problem here. So how do we actually like live in this new digital world at the speed we're going at, when the structure itself that we're relying on for the very nature of governance, as well as the body politic on top of it, is designed to maintain the status quo? So we're talking a lot about innovation, but we've got a human problem and we've got a structural problem. So is it going to take something like an Estonia-level event with a future president to be able to really break through? I don't know what it's going to take, and I'm wondering if you could look forward, what might happen to finally deliver on this vision you have for truly digital government and a stronger society?
An innovative government. Well, first of all, I think that, so I speak in front of thousands and thousands of government officials every year, and that's what this issue is always brought up, which is the risk-averse nature of government. But I think it's oftentimes framed incorrectly, because I think the civil servants will blame legislators, legislators blame civil servants and this and that, and they say, but some of it is, instead of saying failure, maybe we just say test and learn. It's about testing and learning. And because it's really about iteration. So what government has done for too long is assumed that this infallibility, like how many politicians have said failure is not an option? Right? I'll stand in front. And of course, we know failure is an option. It's always an option. One of the best examples of that was the California electricity crisis when they did deregulation and it was passed 98-0 and everything, and all unraveled. And why? Because no one tested it ahead of time, and no one kind of envisioned, wargamed an Enron being able to play the system. And so I think when I talk to legislators and politicians, I say, I'm going to help you to de-risk these projects. I'm going to help you to de-risk it by doing a lot of testing and learning, iterating, A/B things. And so you're going to maybe shut them off well before they become the $20, $30 million kind of white elephant behemoths. Because that's what we've done. We've said failure is not an option. And then they go on. And finally, like, you know, two administrations later, these are killed, right? And that's a terrible way of approaching this. So I think it's just flipping this. And it's all about testing and learning all the time with real users. And that way we're going to de-risk it. And you're going to have a lot of very small failures, but we're going to do that on purpose. The other thing that government can do is do a lot more partnering with the private sector, do prizes and challenges and open it up for the world to do and actually make that part of the process. We're seeing a number of government entities now which are almost approaching it more like a VC, venture capitalist, and saying we're going to do incubators with startups. We're going to do other things. And actually, we're going to assume there is some failure in that. The best agency for all of this is DARPA. So DARPA, of course, is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which they invented the internet. And the best job in government is to be one of the DARPA project managers. Okay, everyone wants it, and they're term limited. They're usually about 4 to 5 years, and you thousands of people apply, and they only get a few get them, and you will not actually win one of these spots unless you put together out their ideas that they think will fail, because otherwise you haven't thought enough about it. So they've built that into their model. And we just need a lot more of that built into the model, because we know we're going to have failures all the time, but we just don't admit it ahead of time. But if you start off saying 30% of these are going to fail, and that's part of our model, then that's a totally different thing psychologically, I think. Yes.
Question?
Hello, my name is Namin. I work in one of the 5 top banks in Mongolia as a policy officer, but I'm a very fresh new officer. So what I would like to know from all I've learned in here is just one sentence or two, so I can base and develop, and that's the way I learn things. So could you please give it one sentence or two, the whole speech.
Okay.
The main ideas, please.
That's a good challenge.
That's
Twitter
it.
I'm going to paraphrase a billboard that I saw recently, which is that don't do digital, be digital. There you go.
Okay, our thank you to Bill Eggers, who is the author of Delivering on Digital, The Innovators and Technologies That Are Transforming Government. This is his latest book. We want to thank him for his presentation here today. We also thank our audience here and those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.